this talk is not about cloud computing as stockage, as data storage. On the left, you've got a nice new data center. In fact, it's a Google data center. And on the right-hand side, there is a room, an infamous room, called Room 641A. And the whole point of this talk, really, is does there exist a room like that inside the big US data centers? Or might there be in future? So I'm talking about cloud computing as processing power, processing of data by huge banks of blade computers, not purely about just storage. So to understand where this talk comes from, we have to remember back in the 2000s, the affair in America called warrantless wiretapping. And this began when, in 2003, a technician who worked for AT&T in San Francisco discovered that in his installation there was being built a secret room, the room I just showed you, 641A. And inside this room was being installed the highest performance deep packet inspection box made at that time by a company called Naris. And what was happening is the fiber optic cable carrying most of the traffic in America along the western seaboard was being split and diverted, one branch, to this DPI box. And presumably some kind of processing and scanning was happening inside this box, and the rest of the traffic was being diverted to the US National Security Agency. And Americans became very upset about this, as you can imagine, because they thought that they were protected by their law, by their constitution, from this type of mass surveillance without a warrant. In 2005, the New York Times published this story. It turned out that Mark Klein had given them the story more than a year before, but they had refused to publish it before the American election. Then, since then, several other whistleblowers have come forward from the NSA, the FBI, and they tried to go through the official media to get this story published. The LA Times wouldn't publish it, and it was very difficult to get the mainstream, it still is very difficult to get the mainstream media in America to cover this story. Then, just before President Obama was elected in 2008, all of this activity was legalized by a temporary piece of legislation called the Protect America Act. And it gave immunity for all the telecommunication companies who may have participated in this, who had huge legal liability. They could have been sued for billions of dollars of damages for being complicit in this activity, complete immunity. And it legalized, really, a new paradigm, which was to try and collect all the data you can, and then afterwards try and sort it and filter it according, really, to who was American and who was not American. So this marked the end of particular warrants describing a particular kind of activity for particular groups of people. It became a system where, with a single authorization, an enormous amount of activity could be carried out for a year at a time. And there has been, in fact, since 1978, a special secret surveillance court called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And instead of approving particular warrants, it now approved procedures, essentially the method by which this was done, but not any particular details. So now we come to 2008, just before Obama was elected, and the law I want to talk about is this 1881A. It covers foreign intelligence information. It intentionally targets only non-US persons outside the US. In other words, the rest of the world, outside America. It gives an authorization for 1 year at a time, and it establishes and consolidates this principle that all of the data can be collected first, and then afterwards you try and filter only what data does not belong to Americans. The telecommunication companies have to provide all the facilities to do this necessary and do that in secret, complete secrecy, and it's a contempt of this surveillance court if they do not comply. Am I talking too fast? Everything okay? People understanding? And again, it consolidated this idea that telecommunication companies have total immunity from civil lawsuits, anyone who wants to get damages for this activity. And all of this has to be done in a manner consistent with the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment, come back to later. So when one looks in the definitions of the law of what does foreign intelligence information mean, virtually every country, including France and Britain, has some sort of mass surveillance law governing this sort of activity. It covers usually national security and criminality, and up there you can see there's sabotage and terrorism and money laundering. But then down there, in the second part, there's some very interesting detail. And when you put together and unwind the definitions, what you find is this. It can be information with respect to a foreign-based political organization or a foreign territory that relates to the conduct of the foreign affairs of the United States. Well, that could be just about anything. Anything in terms of a journalist's research or a company's activities or political activists. You don't even have to be a member of a political party. This could simply be any kind of activity of interest to US foreign policy. And in fact, this definition has been in the American law since 1978. But what happened with 1881A is it brought together three elements together, which hadn't been separate. For the first time, it brought these together. One is this idea of only targeting non-Americans outside America. But the second was what I don't think anybody else noticed is inside the very complex legal definitions, previously that had only applied to telecommunications companies. In other words, to intercepting data on the wire as it's being transmitted. But it included, for the first time, remote computing services. And when you look at the definition, that is what today we would call cloud computing. Nobody noticed this at the time. And the significance is that if you think, for example, your data is somewhat protected by being encrypted by SSL from your laptop up into Google or Facebook's cloud, it doesn't matter because this provides the power to go behind the encryption directly inside the data center and to suck out all of that data from the inside. And that power had not existed before. And then thirdly, as I've mentioned, the scope of this the scope of activity can be purely political surveillance, nothing to do with criminality or what you might call genuine national security. It's designed for mass surveillance of cloud computing. So at data protection conferences over the past few years, representatives from America have often given speeches about how well American law protects privacy. And particularly, they make reference to the famous Fourth Amendment, right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but on probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. It's surprising, perhaps, but there is nothing in the US Constitution which limits this to only Americans. And it was only in a test case in the Supreme Court in 1990, very recently, that US judges held this did not apply to people who are not American or outside the US. And some other details have emerged over the past few years which basically show that this doesn't apply at all. So, in other words, if we are here and we use some American cloud computing service and our data goes within range of US jurisdiction, the Fourth Amendment does not provide any protection whatsoever. Now, I was going to show a little video clip, next, which unfortunately we haven't got the sound for, but I'll tell you what's going on. This is a congressman from Texas, rather a conservative hawk, we might say, and he's questioning two very good representatives from American civil liberties organizations, Jamil Jaffa from ACLU and Mark Rotenberg from EPIC. And he's pressing them about their attempt to get Congress to scrutinize this law, FISA, the impact on Americans, because the Americans are very upset about this law, if you like, because of the spillover, the incidental impact it could have on Americans. But the congressman is pressing them about whether they have any complaint about the rights of you and me, everyone else in the rest of the world. And even though these are very conscientious advocates for privacy and for civil liberties, it is impossible in the political climate of opinion in America for anyone to stand up and say, look, is there something wrong about conducting this mass surveillance on the rest of the world? It is simply politically impossible to do that. So they were driven back to the position of saying, no, we're really just asking you here to examine the impact on the rights of Americans. So also over the past 3 or 4 years, there has been a big marketing campaign from Microsoft, from Google, the other companies, trying to say the cloud is wonderful, everything's protected by law, don't worry, be happy. And if you look at all of these reports down at the bottom, commissioned at different institutions at different times, they all kind of provide reassurance using this argument that United States law provides good protection for its citizens in America, in some cases better protection than for European citizens under European law in Europe. Therefore, there's no problem. Now, I hope you can all see the problem with that argument. None of the reports written for the European Commission or other institutions even mentioned FISA. None of the data protection authorities mentioned FISA. You can go through 150 opinions from the European Group of Data Protection Authorities, the Working Party 29. In 150 opinions written since 9/11, they never mention mass surveillance or FISA even once. And in fact, even probably the most eminent data protection commissioner of Europe, Peter Hustings, who's head of the European Data Protection Supervisor, which governs, if you like, how European institutions use data, he even seems to have approved of the idea of simplifying the transfer of European data into cloud computing in a speech in 2010. So is this idea of mass surveillance through the cloud, is this a real risk or is this a fantasy? So I've mentioned that really encryption can only protect data on the wire, on your way from your computer up into the data center. And the different categories of cloud computing, the most interesting for the future perhaps, is something called platform as a service. And platform as a service, perhaps Hadoop is the best known language for doing this at the moment. What you try and do is write programs in an architecture independent way so that the program can instantly expand elastically to run on 1,000 processors if the demand instantaneously is created for that. And then when the demand goes away, the program scales back. So it's very attractive to write software for the cloud in this platform as a service modality, because it means you don't have to worry about rewriting your systems to expand for demand. And as the world turns, you suddenly get a lot of calls into a data center from customers, and so the demand increases. Well, if you wanted to wiretap all of that data in hardware, what you'd have to do is you'd have to have 100 DPI boxes on standby, just so that when you have the demand, you can have those boxes then intercept the data. That's very expensive and inefficient. So if governments in future really want to wiretap the cloud for processing, they're going to have to persuade Microsoft and Google to do the wiretapping in software. So any subroutine that's actually processing some data, there's a little bit of code underneath that which is also scanning that data for the factors which are of interest for the 1881A orders. And in fact, there is already developed by the European Telecommunications Standards Institute, which has been producing standards for wiretapping, amongst other things, for many years. They actually have a draft paper about this. They've coined the term lawful intercept as a service, using the power of the cloud to wiretap the cloud. So this is a real idea. This is an example of a national security letter under the Patriot Act, a request for data. It was served on an American ISP operator called Nick Merrill, who was gagged for 7 years. For 7 years, he had to fight a court case. He couldn't tell really anybody about it. I think he even had to fight for the right to tell a lawyer about it. But this is not a request. This is a diagram produced by the ACLU from about 2006 about what was known about the extent of the mass interception apparatus. And from the documentation that was given by Mark Klein, there's a little diagram of the AT&T tap down the bottom left, there were indications that it didn't just happen in San Francisco, that there was this surveillance octopus of many of the major switching centers in the US, all feeding data back to the NSA. So it is curious that when you look at data protection authorities writing about this problem, they always talk about the paradigm of requests. They still imagine there is a piece of paper, a legal authority authorizing a particular activity, a particular disclosure. But this is not a request. This is a state of continuous mass surveillance occurring all the time under a blanket authority. And data protection authorities don't seem to be able to understand this, or will not, as it were, assimilate it into their thinking. This is a whistleblower called Bill Binney, who was actually building the state-of-the-art NSA surveillance systems around 9/11. And it's interesting because I was working at the time on a piece of legislation in Britain in civil society before I joined Microsoft, trying to figure out what the British legislation in this area meant by a very close analysis to the detail of the law. And then I was imagining what sort of systems might be being built. And it turns out when Bill Binney started talking about this in public, there's a very good video of his conference speech to hackers on planet Earth from last year. It turned out that Bill Binney was, in fact, building exactly the sort of systems that I had been imagining. He worked on a system called ThinThread, which was acquiring metadata, traffic data, on a mass basis, even before 9/11. And in fact, it was quite elegant because it didn't capture all of the data all the time. It did a sort of look ahead. It looked at people who were associated with the people they already wanted to look at and captured data, as it were, one or two steps ahead, but not everything. So it was quite parsimonious. And he's got a fascinating story to tell about how that system was cancelled because it almost worked too well and was too cheap. And so the NSA commissioned a vastly more expensive system called Trailblazer, which captured everything all the time, and that was an expensive failure. But in terms of actually knowing what was done, in fact, 10 years ago, we've never really had a whistleblower from the inside who's been able to provide as much detail. So now we come on to the part about European data protection. So hands up who thinks that European data protection ought to protect us from this sort of thing. Okay, hands up who thinks it does protect us from this sort of thing. Good. You're getting the idea. So in the new data protection regulation, there are various ways whereby European data can lawfully be sent to other countries, particularly the United States. And I won't go into all of the detail, but European data protection authorities have been worried to some extent about this sort of problem and cloud computing. So they've designed a new method for regulating cloud computing for export of data called Binding Corporate Rules for Data Processors, BCRs for Data Processors. And really, it's a sort of legal fix concocted between the lawyers who work for data protection authorities and the lawyers who work for big companies like Microsoft. I went to the conferences. I was working for Microsoft at the time. And in 2009, I could see them huddling at a table. And I said, what are you talking about? This concept of BCRs processors. I thought, for various reasons, this will never work. But what is going on here is data protection authorities don't really want to take responsibility for this. So this, as it were, very bureaucratic legal mechanism, which looks good on paper, allows a data protection authority to say, well, this all looks fine in law. Of course, if it doesn't work in practice, it's not our fault. It just wasn't implemented properly. And this is why I sort of call it a Maginot line in cyberspace, because when you think about the risks of mass surveillance that I've talked about, then when you look at how Article 29 Working Party talk about how BCRs for processors and cloud computing is going to prevent this happening, in their document in June last year, they do mention, right at the end, this problem of direct access to European data by another country's national security authority. And perhaps as sort of as a result of some of the publicity I've tried to give to this problem, they did include a section there suggesting how this might be prevented. But when you look at their proposal, and again, it's very legalistic and bureaucratic, they give an example from the 1990s when America passed some legislation to try and prevent trade with Cuba. And this had an impact on European companies, because the Americans said, well, any country in the world that trades with Cuba, that also trades with America, we will take sanctions against that company. And the European Commission, quite rightly, said, this is impossible. We cannot have the Americans telling our companies where they can and cannot trade in the world. So they passed this council regulation that said any European company is immunized from any sanctions in European jurisdiction. They are immunized from this. But this legal mechanism, it obviously isn't going to work in this case of cloud computing surveillance, because we will never know that it's happening. We will never have any proof. So the idea that this legal mechanism can protect us from covert surveillance activity is nonsense. But this was, after a year of trying very hard to get data protection authorities to take this problem seriously, this was their best idea. And that's where things stand. And if we look at how this idea of BCRs for processors got going, in 2010, there was an informal working group established between the big players in the industry and the CNIL, the French Data Protection Authority. And I'm sorry to say that the CNIL, for reasons I cannot understand, have been deeply implicated in bringing this BCR idea to the present state, where it is now in the new regulation, and it will happen unless there is some huge change of course. And Peter Hustings, the data protection supervisor, made a speech in April 2010 where he talked about using this use for cloud computing. And in fact, he made this speech at the conference of one of the main American lobbyists, the Business Software Alliance. And part of the reason that cloud computing companies didn't like the existing mechanisms is, you may have read about the situation recently where Google and Apple and Microsoft, they pay very little tax to most European countries because they get taxed in Ireland, where the corporate taxation is very low. Now, it turns out when you try and do the legal engineering to make the data protection model fit with the taxation model, you get contracts which are enormously complicated and horrible looking if you're a lawyer. So in a sense, this mechanism was designed to reduce the problem of the lawyers. It wasn't really designed to provide any meaningful privacy protection. And then when we find January last year, the new data protection draft regulation was published by the Commission, it has this clause that says, if you have one of these binding corporate rules in place, that's enough. And all the data whoosh, can then go straight over. So what's going on here is basically a magic trick, abracadabra. One, Microsoft or Google or Facebook gets their BCR certified. Two, data protection authorities everywhere in Europe must accept this because that's what the regulation says. And then three, bang, the data's gone. And it's a sleight of hand. And the questions of mass surveillance just disappear. So another way that Article 29 and indeed the CNIL think that this problem can be managed is in their guidance on how these BCR processes should be formulated. They talk about the company, Microsoft or Google, having to get a security audit. Sounds good. But the sort of security audit that they mean is just auditing against risks of hackers, against external threats, against data being lost. The paradigm of lawful under American law, lawful access under national security law, that's not part of the threat model. There's no private sector auditor that you can get, and obviously a lot of these companies are American, where they're going to be able to poke around the data center and say, oh, that box looks interesting, what does that do? It's for the National Security Agency. Oh, okay. They can't talk about that. That's part of the secret world. So it's curious that Article 29 say this audit, it might include, or it might not include, mandatory requirements for data under national security law. You'd think that would be pretty important. But they just say, yeah, maybe, maybe not. So data protection authorities, again, don't seem to be aware that this is not something that auditors can detect. But anyway, it's sort of worse than that. Because when you look in the detail further in the document, they say that, well, if this direct request to access data occurs, you cannot comply with it as a data processor. So Microsoft and Google cannot comply with this direct request unless they have to. And they have to in secret. And if the law says that they have to comply and they have to comply in secret, that's okay. So it's a case where the law has been arranged to say, you absolutely must not do this unless you have to, and then you can. It's a pure legal fiction. Now, also, between the US and the EU at the level of the European Commission, there have been, for several years, discussion about a so-called umbrella agreement, which is supposed to cover all of these sorts of cases. And it began after the case of the PNR data for traveling by plane when, around 2006, the Americans demanded that all of the data from passenger name records could be directly accessible by the US authorities. The European Parliament didn't like it, but eventually they had to sort of concede, and there's a long story about that. But as a result of that, this high-level diplomatic dialogue began between the Commission and the EU. And the admirable organisation Statewatch, an NGO in the UK, often gets leaks of official documents from inside the European Council. And they got a leak of this in 2011. And the United States position is that this umbrella agreement should not apply at all to data transferred from a private party in Europe to a private party in the US. Well, that is precisely the situation of cloud computing, where you have a European data controller, a private party, transferring data to a private party in the US, a cloud provider. So the way in which these negotiations are being done would not give any assurance against the risks I've talked about. So it's been quite frustrating trying to tell this story. It's been impossible virtually to get it into the Anglo-Saxon newspapers. There have been a few stories I managed to get into German press and some French technical press. But then I had a stroke of luck. An academic who I know, Professor Didier Bogo, who has a research group also associated with the Centre for European Policy Studies in Brussels, invited me to join a report he'd been commissioned to write for the European Parliament. And so I told Didier about this problem, and marvelously, he allowed me to write a large section of the report describing this problem. Probably this report was being commissioned by the European Parliament because they wanted a table-thumping report about how terrible the problem of cybercrime was and how we must have strict new laws to fight cybercrime. But we managed to turn the report around so that it mainly became a description of this problem. And then nothing happened, as often happens with European Parliament reports. It was published, no media report whatsoever. It was sitting on the European Parliament website, nobody read it, and I got very annoyed about this. So back in December last year, just between Christmas and New Year, in fact, the US Congress was debating the renewal of the FISA law. It had a time limit on it in 2008, and it had to be renewed. So when would they renew it? Obviously between Christmas and New Year, when everyone was on holiday. So there was one day of quite interesting debate, which I was watching on C-SPAN, streamed over the internet, and I just got fed up. So I started ringing up all the journalist contacts I knew. And in fact, it was an American, an Irish journalist working for Slate magazine, who I got in contact with, and he wrote a very precise, accurate story of 800 words on an American blog, and then it kicked off. And then we began to see some media coverage. But it's so ironic that it actually took an American blog to publish a story which I've been trying to give to European press for more than a year. But after that, on Twitter, there were 1,500 tweets in a week, and the European comments seemed to be, how can this be possible? What on earth is European data protection for if it doesn't protect us from this sort of thing? The reaction on US blogs is much less, but rather cynically, oh, the Europeans are upset about this. Well, who's going to stop us? It was extremely cynical. So to summarize, the problem with cloud valence, as I call it, is it's potentially about all European data, whereas Echelon is really only about that data which is transmitted and is exposed. And you can encrypt that. That can protect the encryption. But you know, I began to be worried about this when I saw the marketing plan of Microsoft back 3 years ago. And Microsoft's marketing goal was basically to capture all data processed in-premise within Europe, from government, from industry, from the private sector. Microsoft wants to win all of those contracts and process that in the cloud, because the cloud can be 10 times cheaper. I mean, not often, but that's the sort of price reduction that could be involved. And so it's the big American cloud providers who are currently sitting pretty who are going to capture all of that business. And any of that data put within range of American jurisdiction, I don't know if those fiber optic cables are already inside Microsoft or Google in the past 5 years. But if they haven't been in the past 5 years, I think they will be in the next 5 years. And there is a basic difference between American law and European law in this respect. European human rights law and almost all national European law governing national security surveillance does not mention the nationality of the targets. And the European Convention of Human Rights does not allow judges to discriminate your privacy rights by nationality. It's simply inconceivable. But in fact, since 1978, but exacerbated by this FISA law, we have this double discrimination according to whether you're American or not. Firstly, because the 1881 law is only targeted at the rest of the world. And secondly, in fact, when you look at the definition of foreign intelligence information, which I showed earlier, that part about data which relates to US foreign policy, that only applies if you're not American. If you're an American, then that part reads data which is necessary for the pursuit of US foreign policy. Obviously a much higher hurdle. So there is this completely overt double discrimination effect in American law, which simply isn't there in European law. But perhaps the most disturbing part is European institutions, data protection authorities, and the Commission have seemed to be complicit in this. So that's the story, and of course I'd be very happy to take any questions. Thank you very much for your attention.
Hello, I'm very pleased to talk with you. Recently, I'm working in a very small company. We became client of Google services, and the salesman we've got by phone assured us that every bit of information coming from our company was have a special bit for the NSA. So, should I say to my boss, this is completely bullshit?
Sorry, they have a special bit for...
They told us, because we buy the services, every data that is coming from European companies has a special bit saying to the NSA, don't watch this, there is privacy regulation in Europe. So I think, I am sure that this is completely bullshit, but you say this is true.
So the special bit is supposed to say, this is European data, so let's have a look at it, or a special bit, this is European data, so we cannot look at it. Ah. And Google said this? Okay. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that. I mean, in the commercial battle between Google and Microsoft, and I hope everyone by now understands, I have no brief for Microsoft. I do not like anything about Microsoft. Going back 3-4 years ago, there was a discussion about how to compete with Google. And in the technical architecture, Google is more advanced in terms of platform as a service, and really Microsoft Azure, for example, is really just a Microsoft server with a few little bits to make it run virtualized. So in fact, it was easier for Microsoft to say, we will only keep your data inside European data centers. And it's actually quite hard for Google to isolate the processing in a particular local data center. But it doesn't necessarily answer your question, but there's a couple of interesting things. One is that Google got quite annoyed when the National Security Agency, because they want to do a lot of cloud computing, they took some of Google's open source software and produced something called Accumulo, which was essentially a dialect of Hadoop, which has labeling, which can try and geographically localize data and actually let you know where the data physically is. And Google got quite annoyed about this because, in a sense, this disproved their marketing that the cloud, well, it's everywhere. How can you regulate the cloud? You know, it's impossible. And it's ironic that it's the NSA that was actually working on the technology to do this geolocalization. But don't bother to look up Accumulo because it's not really that interesting from a security point of view. I think another point that needs making is a lot of politicians are fixated on the question of where the data physically is located, where the disks are. And that doesn't matter because the fabric software that actually controls the cloud, typically that is administered either from Seattle or San Antonio in the US, or maybe Hyderabad in India when the shift changes. So if the entire fabric of the cloud software is remote controlled from outside the EU, well, it can do anything. You can extract any amount of data that you want, and bandwidth isn't a problem because the whole point of the cloud is that for backup, data is replicated instantly. It's written on disks in 3 continents instantly. So the bandwidth to extract any amount of this data by remote control is already there. So if, for example, the Americans wanted to create an 8181 order to force Microsoft or Google to get data from a European data center, it would be extremely difficult to detect that this was happening. And the politicians don't, again, seem to understand this yet. I hope that's some answer.
You presented that there are problems with US clouds. US companies control a lot more than clouds. They control some controls devices or certificate authorities. Is there a concern also on, for example, is it possible that they have implemented backdoors in phones or?
Yes, it is possible. And I haven't discussed any of those sorts of risks today. One is because there's been a lot of open, good research on that kind of problem, on certificate spoofing, Chris Segoyan's work on that from 2 or 3 years ago, and I think that's a very serious attack. It's particularly serious for, say, human rights activists in countries where there may be a certificate chain to a dodgy certificate authority that is controlled by the government, and then if you read that analysis, then it's terrifying because you simply never know whether you can trust your SSL. But, and it's also true that we don't know what goes on inside proprietary CPU chips. You know, AMD or Intel, you can have a magic sequence of instructions which, bang, would then privilege, escalate the privilege. We don't know whether those things exist. I guess in the future we will need 100% open source hardware. And I hope maybe we do get that. But in somehow, in comparison to the risks I've talked about, I don't think they're the same order of magnitude. Because when you're talking about one particular certificate compromise or trying to extract data and compromise a system at the level of a CPU or microcode, they are pinpoint attacks. They are used. They would be used for very precise circumstances, and the techniques would be closely guarded and not exposed too much, because every time you use that technique, you risk exposure. What I'm talking about here is the industrialization of mass surveillance of the entire cloud, quite lawfully under American law, and apparently with the full knowledge of our European authorities. And I think that's, in some ways, much more shocking.
Just a remark. I just think it's a great opportunity for European company who can make European cloud.
I completely agree. And this is what I have been talking with the Free Software Foundation about, and also with DG Connect. In fact, there is a workshop next week in Brussels with DG Connect. And to be blunt, DG Connect, who have the mandate for technical security and security research, they have completely ignored this problem in all of their work on cloud computing. If you look at the reports they've commissioned from reputable think tanks, none of those reports even discuss anything like this risk. And in fact, the official strategy of the EU at the moment is the so-called European Cloud Partnership, which is a budget of 15 million euros. That's a marketing budget. That's not a research budget. And I think what I would like to see is essentially a European cloud industry, essentially our Airbus, to match the Americans' Boeing and get to a level where we have, you know, a parity of capacity in software, particularly in software. And I think it has to be open source software. There's an interesting argument about whether open source software and what kind of open source software could actually protect you from or give you much more assurance that the software was not backdoored. And it's probably don't have that time for that argument now, but I think there is actually very good reason for thinking that for cloud computing, open source software is absolutely necessary. And that's why I really want nothing to do with proprietary software in terms of cloud computing anymore. But you're absolutely right. A problem that we have is one of the only sort of groups of companies with the commercial scale to invest, to make the necessary investment, are the national telecommunication companies, France Telecom, Deutsche Telekom. And so far, they have not really been convinced that it is a good investment to build their own cloud stack and capacity vertically. And the reason is that they don't have any confidence in the European regulators not to let our data go to the cheapest bidder, to the American companies, because then they would have no possible competitive advantage against the enormous scale of Google and Microsoft. So we need a sort of twin strategy. We need to get a tough regulation that will prevent this sort of data being put at risk, and then that will actually give incentives to European big companies to make the necessary scale of investment in cloud, particularly in software.
You mentioned different technical approach to preserve privacy, but what about laws and going to lobbying into the European Parliament and some of the things like this? Is there some actions in that way?
So I have to be a little bit tactful here. hell, I won't be tactful. So when I left Microsoft, I left Microsoft because I had an enormous blazing row inside Microsoft with the American lawyers about this. And I essentially made the same speech I've just given to you at a very senior level inside Microsoft in February 2011. 3 months later, they fired me. So when I left Microsoft, I started trying to talk about this problem to European civil society. And I expected European civil society to say, oh my God, this is terrible. We must make this one of the biggest priorities for our activity campaigning about the new data protection reform. And I don't really understand why, but I could not really get many of the people in European civil society to be interested in this. They didn't seem to think it was important. And in fact, I must be quite a difficult personality because they didn't want to work with me. So I'm not really persona grata now with the main European civil society group. So the work I've done to try and bring attention to this, there's two other researchers who are in the Netherlands who are interested in this problem and virtually nobody else. So I would really like people in sort of civil society to realize the problem we have and come and help and get active on this campaign, because there is very little really being done by civil society about this problem in Brussels so far. I managed to get 5 amendments tabled to the data protection reform. As you probably know, there are 4,000 amendments to this thing. So that whole reform package is completely hung up now. And essentially the anti-privacy lobbying forces are trying to block any progress. But I'm afraid this agenda is a tiny, tiny, tiny part of that, which is still not really on the radar of most people. So there's an awful lot of work to do in the next month, really, when the voting happens. And I would love people to get discussion about this and perhaps support the amendments that I've tabled. I could tell you a little bit about the amendments that I've tabled. They're not perfect, but they're the best idea I've had. One amendment says that there are maybe 5 ways through which European data can lawfully go to America at the moment. One is safe harbor, which doesn't mean anything. Another is model contract clauses, which actually have the same problem, but just not the tax problem that I mentioned earlier. The third is consent, and then there's a few others. And then, of course, there's the new one of binding corporate rules for processes, which I mentioned. So my proposal is that if European data is going to go to America, the data subject must get an absolutely prominent warning, and the warning has got to be a pop-up screen, and it's got to say, do you realize, if you click OK, that your data could be then subject to political surveillance by a foreign government's intelligence agency. As clear as that. I guess you can't make it any more clear. So in some respects, that's an impractical amendment, because, of course, all of the governments that already gather your data, all of the businesses that already gather your data, they want to use cheap cloud computing, and they're going to say, we can't possibly go back and contact individual data subjects. And of course, if we did and we showed them that warning, people would have to be crazy to agree to that. Well, part of the purpose of my amendment is to create a political effect. I want people to ask questions about this. I mean, it's very difficult to see that this will actually be seriously adopted, but that, if you like, is the political intent, at least to make MEPs think about this problem. The second group of amendments is to encourage whistleblowers. If you imagine that inside Microsoft, this sort of system could be implemented with just 5 or 6 people. The chief executive would have to know about it. The chief national security lawyer would have to know about it. And then you need maybe only 5 or 6 programmers to implement this. And that could be the circle of secrecy. So if Europeans are ever going to find out that this is going on, we need a whistleblower from inside the American government or inside Google or Microsoft. So my proposal is that we should actually set up whistleblower protection and make it easy and safe for those whistleblowers to come and tell European data protection authorities. And at the moment, European data protection authorities, from what I said, they don't want to hear. So it's not just a question of passing a law. We also have to change the culture inside data protection authorities, which are really just stuffed with bureaucrats and lawyers. And they don't understand the technology. But more seriously, when it's explained to them, they just don't want to deal with this. It's too sort of frightening for them, almost. So, nevertheless, even though those amendments are unsatisfactory, they are actually the only things that are around in the reform. So there has to be a huge activation, like we had on ACTA or some of the other campaigns before, to get this problem up the agenda.
Well, hello? Yeah. I was thinking that also another thing that is very important is the architecture of internet. Because you didn't mention, that's what I point out. And I today was in one block in Spain, because South America make a ring, wants to build a ring that don't have to pass to US, because I guess it's another problem, right? Because if we pass to US, even if we encourage servers in Europe, but then we pass in US, they can just intercept because it will just pass their territory. And I guess this will be the next thing also to point out in the regulation. Because maybe we have to build a new infrastructure to go to South America, for example, very strategic for Europe as well, which is kind of an emerging continent, and don't pass to US because the cables that right now are built more Europe-US than US down.
So I agree with that. And in fact, there's a nice project called IX Maps at the University of Toronto, which basically uses ping to map where your packets go and show that, in fact, you know, if you're in Canada and you just want to communicate with a Canadian town 100 miles away, often your data will go via the US. But in some sense, if you still believe in encryption, you know, there are rumors that some encryption that we now think is safe is maybe not safe, but if you still believe in encryption, then providing you're transmitting data from a safe place to a safe place, then the routing shouldn't really matter. I mean, I think it's still a concern. It's better to know where your data is traveling, if you like. But in some sense, the problem I'm describing is slightly different. It is that if you're using particularly proprietary software, or if you're using an American firm with the cloud as we know it, then the wiretapping can happen from the inside. So it would be done in secret, and that nullifies any encryption. So, for example, if you wanted to imagine technical protection, how can this be done? Obviously, to do useful work on the data, the cloud provider has to be able to decrypt the data. There is an idea, mathematical idea, for which sounds very wacky, it is, where you can actually compute on encrypted data, and it's called homomorphic encryption. But frankly, the best algorithm that we know was only discovered 4 years ago, and there's been a slight improvement since. It's about 1 trillion times too slow. So no one's going to use this in the foreseeable future. And things like technical protection measures, TPM chips, the sort of things that Palladium, they're not built to withstand a national security agency. So you can't really imagine trusted hardware solving the problem in any time soon, too. So this is the real dilemma. There is no technical defense from what I've described. The only way is to have your own data centers, your own software infrastructure, and to keep the data within Europe.
We have time for one other question.
Hi. So when I'm using Azure to back up my data, I'm creating the passphrase from my side. So in your opinion, NSA will gonna brute force this passphrase?
Well, the passphrase will be sort of setting up several things. It'll be mainly setting up your SSL connection from...
No, this is about the data that's backed up over there, not the transmission.
Well, in the Azure framework, right, it's still going to be processed in Microsoft data centers. And so the data has to be decrypted by Microsoft. So
this is not what they say.
Well, then you need to, I mean, the marketing material from Microsoft, in fact, all of these companies, is written to be ambiguous. And when you read it very, very, very closely, I think you'll find, I mean, but logically speaking, you understand my point, is in order for the work to be done on the data, Microsoft has to be able to see the data. I mean, you can't compute with encrypted data, not using algorithms that we know today.
Yeah, it's not efficient.
Yeah, it's not efficient. So when it's interesting when you compare what Google and Microsoft have said about this problem publicly, what's in their security contracts, how that's changed the past 3 years. but essentially, I mean, there's nothing really you can rely on against what I said. And you know, it doesn't work legally, it doesn't work technically.
Thanks. Okay.
Thank you, Kasper.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate it. Thanks.